done fell right down that rabbit hole. So reality is questionable. Try, but you just can't let it go. These two right here put on the show. It's paranormal overload with Southern hospitality. Haunted murder mayhem tip while discussing immortality. Locations with a dark past, history that comes to life. Hillbillies with a knack for everything that goes bump at night. Overthinking if you by yourself, these two will have you turning on the lights. Mixing in a little comedy to make sure it all fits in just right. Hey.
Welcome to Hillbilly Horror Stories. Now here's your hosts, Jerry and Tracy Hawk, and their dog Ninja.
Sometimes their cat, Freddy, but never the ferrets.
Hey guys, welcome to episode 404 of Hillbilly Horror Stories. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Tracy.
You are.
I am. Daggone it.
So Tracy, obviously we start off every episode thanking all of our military and civil servants. No matter which country you represent, thanks to all you men, women, and service animals for everything that you do for us on a daily basis.
Yes, thank you guys so much. That includes paramedics, policemen, firemen. We just have the utmost respect for all of you guys, and we know how hard you guys work. And we just want to know that we pray for you guys all the time, and thank you for keeping us safe. We love you all.
So, Tracy, I had a longtime friend, listener to the show, supporter, been to some live events. We'll keep it anonymous, but they have really been struggling lately. Times are tough financially for them. There's two in the family, but only one is able to work because of some disability issues, so that job, the job that the one person of the couple was actually working, looks like it could be coming to an end. So obviously the thought of just no financial support coming in for your family is absolutely horrible. And it was weighing on them, and they reached out to me this morning, and I spent about 15 minutes on the phone on the way to work, just talking to them and trying to help them. And you know, and this is sad, but it's a positive. Okay. This person told me that they had to do a questionnaire about who to contact. And they realized at that point that the only person that they could reach out to was their mom and me.
Oh, no kidding.
That's the way they felt. And I'm glad to at least be an outlet for somebody, because it, you know, some people really feel like they don't have anybody, and I'm glad that they at least felt like they could reach out to me, and they did.
Well, that's very nice, and I'm glad that you did. And we'll just say prayers for you, because something positive's going to come your way. I just feel it. You guys can always reach out to us. You can reach out to our group. Our group is fantastic. We can't thank them enough for what they do every day in that group. And, you know, please just reach out. We'll talk to you. We'll listen, whatever needs to be done. You can also call the crisis hotline at 988, text 741-741. But we're here for you guys, okay? No matter what time, day or night, please, please reach out.
Yes, ma'am. All right, Tracy. So, first of all, before we get started on this, we have a very special guest tonight.
All right.
Cody Richardson from one of my all-time favorite YouTube channels, Mystery Archives.
Nice.
Is on. It's a huge channel. He does a great job. He's a good storyteller. He's been doing this for like 8 years.
Oh, good for him.
And it's just like I said, it's a channel I absolutely love. And I might have fanboyed a little bit. I'm not going to lie to you. I don't get to do that too often, yeah. But I actually did in this case. And we had some fun talk about, you know, paranormal investigating and some of the stories that he covered on his channel and stuff like that. So it's one where you get some very cool stories out of it.
Oh, how exciting.
You guys will like.
Awesome.
All right. Tonight's story is going to be a little different. I'll just say it. Every time, Tracy, we do missing person stories, you know, the ones that just are unique.
Mm-hmm.
Not your average ones, but the ones like the missing 411s and stuff like that, we always get a great response out of.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously there's not much paranormal to some of these. Some of them could have a little bit of a twist to it. So I don't do them very often, but let's face it. Some of these are horror stories, whether they're paranormal or not. We've always advertised ourselves as a mostly paranormal show, but we dip into some cults or something every once in a while. So that's what we're going to do tonight. And the main reason for this is I've actually ran across a couple of stories that I thought would be really good to do. So, strange disappearances are my bag, baby.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's so sad that these stories happen, but they're fascinating at the same time. It's because you just can't fathom how somebody like just disappears.
Well, and one of these stories, we've got two stories tonight.
Okay.
And one of them will definitely have that kind of appeal to it. This first one is more of a true crime story, I think. Even though we don't really get the ending, I think we can all kind of figure out that there was some foul play involved. We're going to talk about William Patterson and his wife, Margaret. Now, it's crucial to learn a little bit about William Patterson, or Pat, as he will be known the rest of the episodes, because that kind of what his family and friends called him. Pat was the consummate charmer and salesperson.
Like you?
No, even better than me.
No, even better than you?
I don't consider myself to be that great of a salesperson.
That's not right. You are. But go ahead.
Well, but thank you. He grew up in the poor side and in the slums of Chicago in the early 1900s. He spent time traveling in a carnival in the 1920s.
Oh.
At the carnival, he would actually spend his spare time womanizing and his work time using his unique gift of gab, pretty much conning carnival visitors out of their hard-earned money on these rigged games and attractions.
Oh.
You know how to carnival.
Oh, works. I know. I thought you was going to say maybe he had a kissing booth or something.
No. In the 1930s, he moved to Indiana, and he started to work in a string of different sales jobs. While he was in Indiana, he met his future wife, Margaret. The two fell in love, and from everything I read, Margaret's family just did not like Pat at all. They felt that he was a shyster, so they pretty much had him pegged, even though they had never met him.
I don't understand that. How you can judge somebody when you haven't even met them.
Well, here's the main thing. Margaret and her family were Catholic, and Pat was not Catholic. And in the 1930s and 40s, that would have been a huge deal.
Oh, I'm sure.
So that was their major issue. They didn't have to know him to know that they didn't like that part about him. But judging by what Margaret had told them about him as far as the carnival and the salespeople. And you got to realize, salespeople didn't exactly have a great reputation back in the day either.
Yeah.
So now you got a salesman who's probably a
non-Catholic salesman.
A non-Catholic salesperson, and you got the ultimate, we don't want our daughter with this guy. So Margaret never introduced him to her parents because of that. So there was no point. And by some accounts, Margaret's family made her choose between being with Pat or being a part of their family.
Oh, let's see.
And
that's not cool.
Yeah. She pretty much chose Pat. Yeah. So we discussed that Pat grew up poor. Sometime around the time that he met Margaret, he became increasingly interested in money. So much so that it became his primary focus. So Pat started bouncing around jobs. And eventually, he would become a salesman for a camera company. This was going to be huge for his future. It was actually going to be the opportunity that would change the rest of his life. So while working in this job, he discovered that he actually had a pretty good talent for photography. And around 1940, Pat and Margaret moved to El Paso, Texas. Tracy, it was in El Paso that Pat met a local moneylender. Now, this is how good of a salesman Pat actually was. He talked this lender, who he did not know, into giving him an unsecured loan to start a business.
All right, good for him.
So you're new to town.
Yep.
You don't know this person from Adam. He don't know anything about your background, and he just agrees to give you an unsecured loan.
Well, I mean, what, Pat's confident, so he just sold it.
Apparently. Because, I mean, you normally need some type of collateral or something, definitely. Especially being new someplace. But
he had a camera.
I'm sure he probably did have a camera. So he convinced this lender that his business idea was a good one. And he was right.
Well, good.
Pat wanted to open a photo supply company. And by 1950, his company was booming. By 1956, it was bringing in $350,000 a year. That's over $4 million in today's money.
So it was like a Polaroid? Was it Polaroid back
then? I guess
it
was just anything that people needed, film or parts to camera, lenses.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome.
Anything
though.
That you would need.
Perfect.
For cameras, from my understanding, is what he did. So like I said, $4 million is what he was bringing in a year. And for somebody who never had money, they took advantage of it.
Yeah.
He and Margaret had a very nice house. They wore nice clothes, and they had nice toys such as sports cars and a boat. Now, of course, he and Margaret also had plenty of expensive pieces of jewelry, such as expensive watches that he had. She had some nice rings, nice necklaces, stuff like that. You know, it's okay to, I guess, flaunt your wealth in such a way, especially if you grew up with nothing, but apparently, Pat was known to be a very big braggart, so much to the point that he rubbed people the wrong way.
Right.
He developed a reputation for
you
being
know,
that way.
Flaunt your stuff at the beginning just because it's exciting, but then, you know, slow your roll.
Yeah. Most people kind of looked at him as a jerk. And sometimes that would get him in trouble. A good example of this was in February of 1956. He was in a trip to Juarez, Mexico. And while he was there, he went to a bar. Pat ordered a drink for a young lady that he was with.
Wait, where was his wife?
She wasn't with him on this trip, apparently.
Whoa.
So some reports said that this was a woman that worked there, while others say that this was a mistress that he had brought to the bar. Regardless, she was 20 years old, and Pat was like 60s.
Yeah, and she's not 21, so it's not legal to drink.
I don't know that, because in some places it's legal at 18, and there's states where it's legal at 18 here in the U.S.
Okay.
But my guess is in Mexico you didn't have to be 20. But whatever the situation was back then, Pat lost his temper when a waiter refused to serve them. I don't know why he didn't serve them or why she didn't serve them, whatever the deal was. But Pat got irate. And he starts cussing and throwing a fit. Well, two bouncers came over and they politely asked him to lower his voice. But that only made things worse. It's like asking a woman to calm down.
Yeah.
Man, Freddie. Sorry, Freddie kind of had a moment. So these guys basically tell him to calm down a little bit. And I think at that point, Pat must have confused wealth with muscles. Because in the end, he just got himself beaten up pretty badly and thrown out of the club.
Yeah, see? There ain't no sense in all that stuff. Just go out. I'm sure there was other bars you could go to.
Yeah, he definitely had the ability to rub people the wrong way. All right, so let's get into the meat of this story, now that you know a little bit of background about Pat and Margaret. About a year later, on Monday, March 4th, 1957, Pat was at his house. They were working on a boat with a friend of his by the name of Cecil Ward. Now, Cecil was not only a friend, he also owned a high-end car garage. And he was Pat's personal mechanic. That's how they got to know each other. On this particular evening, Cecil And his wife had come over to Pat's to have a nice little dinner. It was a little dinner party that they were invited over for. But after dinner, Pat asked Cecil if he would help him put a glass covering on his boat. I really don't know what that is.
I don't either.
Somebody who owns boats will tell us what that is.
Definitely.
While they were doing this, Cecil's wife and Margaret were in the living room just kind of chatting about, you know, whatever the times or events were that were going on in their lives. Now, it's important to note that neither Pat nor Margaret mentioned anything about any upcoming trips. Pat pretty much just talked about what he wanted to do with the boat as far as getting it, you know, working properly. And places that they did want to use the boat to travel to later in the year. But nothing about anything pending. At the end of the night, Pat asked Cecil if he could come back the following night to help him finish up the job. But Cecil said he already had plans for the next night, so he couldn't come. Well, here's where things start to get a little strange. 2 days later, on the morning of March 6th, Cecil got to his shop and he sees Pat's Cadillac parked outside. But Pat wasn't there. Instead, it was a mutual friend of Cecil's and Pat's, a gentleman by the name of Doyle Kirkland, or Kirk, as he is better known. He tells Cecil that Pat wanted him to bring in the car so he could get it serviced. Apparently, the horn wasn't working. Now, here's the kicker. Kirk was the manager of a rival photography supply shop.
Well, that's weird.
So even though the two were rivals, Kirk and Pat had been really close friends for years. So even though it seemed odd to Cecil that Kirk would actually have Pat's car, Kirk went on to tell Cecil that he had been at Pat's the night before helping him with his boat. So that starts to make a little more sense. And then that's when it doesn't make sense. Kirk says he went home, and at about 3 a.m., his phone rings, wakes him up. It was Pat. On the call, Pat says that he's taken Margaret away for a little while on a trip. Well, going on a trip in itself wasn't really all that unusual. In fact, they would go on long trips to Florida, sometimes months at a time. But in these situations, he would lead the staff in charge of the shop, and they would know about it in advance. He wouldn't just take off.
So they weren't taking a trip on the boat, right? They were just going off in the car. Okay.
He just said they were just taking a trip. And nobody seemed to know about this, so the staff didn't know anything about it, or they would have been prepared to run the place. Now, what was unusual about this is taking a last second trip like that without letting anybody know, especially so early in the morning. Why do you call somebody at 3 o'clock in the morning?
No, I don't know. That's very odd.
As strange as all this seemed, it did seem to check out because a week later on March 15th, Pat's accountant, Herb, who we'll hear a lot of in this episode, he received a telegram. It was sent from a Western Union telephone pay booth at Love Field Airport in Dallas. It said that Kirk should be made the manager of Pat's store and that a trailer that Pat owned should be sold and the money put into the business. Also, that their home should be rented for the next 9 months. Pat had also been planning to attend a photography convention in Washington State, and he asked them to cancel that reservation. So,
there's all kinds of weird stuff going on here.
He also said to do all of this as quiet as possible. It was important. And it says, "Sure you understand, Pat." That telegram was the last communication that anyone ever had with Pat or Margaret.
Oh, no way.
So let's kind of look at the situation. He leaves abruptly, according to Kirk. Then a telegram comes in to his accountant telling him to sell a trailer, put the money into the business, and to make Kirk the new manager down there. But so he wants Kirk to be the new manager, but Kirk doesn't know anything about anything except for the fact that he got a call saying he was leaving at 3 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
That seems strange in its own right. And then,
and why specifically 9 months?
I don't know. And that's the other thing. So put the house up for rent for 9 months. So that sounds like that could be legit. And to cancel the appointment. Well, I mean, why would you, if there's something, if this wasn't him, why would he care about canceling the, invitation mm-hmm. for reservation, I should say, for out at the photography convention? First of all, why would he care?
Who cares?
If you just don't make it, you don't make it.
You make it, exactly.
But anyways, that was mentioned, so it's pretty specific. All right. So about a month later, there was a strange development. The son of Pat and Margaret's next-door neighbor runs into the house. He was excited, talking about how Tommy had come back. Tommy was Margaret's cat. The cat was very thin and looked pretty bad. Matter of fact, it looked like it had come back from the pet cemetery.
Mm.
Now, this was a pretty big development because whenever Margaret would go out on a trip, she would always leave her cat with an animal hospital to be looked after.
Oh.
You see, this cat was a child to Margaret. It was her pride and joy. So much so, she even fed this cat caviar sometimes.
Wow. But it seems like if Tommy was her pride and joy, why would she want to leave the cat for that long a period of time? I mean, 9 months is a long time.
Well, I don't know, but that's really not the point. The point is that she would have left him in the hands of the hospital or something mm-hmm. to look after him. She wouldn't just, he wouldn't just been out on his own.
Right, right.
Which it looked like. So this wouldn't be the only inconsistency that would pop up. They had also left some very expensive clothing at the dry cleaners. That's something that Margaret would always pick up before they went out on trips.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the mail, you know, that was a big deal of getting mail redirected. The mail wasn't redirected until a month later, and even then it was only redirected to the Photoshop. I don't know who thought to get the mail directed. If this wasn't Margaret and Pat,
mm-hmm.
who redirected the mail? I mean, I guess anybody could do it, but what's the point of redirecting
it? I don't know.
I don't know. Pat's father actually lived nearby, and he wasn't really surprised. He said in a later interview that he knew the couple would eventually disappear one day.
Wow.
He said this was behavior that Pat had exhibited before, for example, when he joined the carnival. Remember we talked about that?
Oh, yeah.
So about a year later, Pat's business went into a receivership, and his accountant, Herb, was appointed the receiver. So if you're unfamiliar with what that is, when a company goes into receivership, it's sort of like a bankruptcy. It means that it can't really pay its creditors, and this is actually a way for creditors to recover some of their debts. It can help troubled companies to avoid bankruptcy, and the goal here is to return them back into a profitable company. So you would think the company was struggling.
Mm-hmm.
That wouldn't really be the case here, though. That would be the normal circumstances, but not here. The only reason that Pat's company was falling behind in her debts is because the bank refused to issue checks by the company because they hadn't heard from Pat in so long.
Oh.
So they were just like, nope, we're just holding on to all the money and we're not going to pay anything until we know what the hell's going on. So with Herb as the receiver, he could then deposit any money that they made and get checks cleared. So this meant that the company was now in the hands of him.
Mm-hmm.
And Kirk as the manager. So now they're running the company. Herb then starts taking a salary, remember he's the accountant, of $800 a month. That's the equivalent of $9,000 today.
Duh.
A month.
Wow.
He also set up another $200 a month for his law firm to be kept on retainer. That's about another $2,300 in today's money. How about that?
Hey, I shouldn't have left.
Well, shortly after this, Herb supposedly received a letter from Pat, and it was from Laredo, Texas. It said that he and Margaret were not coming back, and they were leaving the country where no one could find them. The letter said to split their property between Kirk, Herb, and one of Pat's employees there at the shop. This was a handwritten letter, and unfortunately, handwriting experts could not determine
if that was Pat really him. Mm-hmm.
Had actually written this letter or not. So as you could imagine, the police had doubts, especially since the land wasn't divvied up to his father or his siblings.
Yeah, that's weird.
And it was given, you know, to, you know, Kirk and Herb and the other guy. Because the handwriting was in question, the assets were never handed over. So they weren't divided up.
So what happened to it then?
I guess they just held on to it for the time being. About a year later, a tip came in that the couple had been seen in a little small Mexican village called Valle de Bravo. But that turned out to be a case of mistaken identity. Soon after, there were sightings and tips that came in from all over the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. Those tips led nowhere.
I mean, so were the police involved at all? Or they just said, well, they said, you know, we're just going where we can't be found. And they just didn't.
I think they were starting to get involved because that's where these tips and stuff were coming in at. That's why the tips were coming
in. Okay. Well, that makes sense. Okay.
Finally, in March of 1964, the couple was declared dead.
Oh, no.
7 years after they had disappeared. Because, you know, that happens for a while. When people disappear after a period of time, they eventually declare them dead.
Wow, I did not know that.
So this case went for pretty much cold for 20 years until 1984. That year, a homicide detective was looking into the case, and he got new evidence from the couple's old caretaker. He claimed that on the day they disappeared, he found blood in the garage and a piece of what he thought was a human scalp on the propeller of Pat's boat.
What? Why did he not tell this back then?
Well, we're getting to that.
Oh.
There are other reports that said that he also saw an associate of Pat's throw bloody sheets into the trunk of a car. The associate wasn't identified, so we don't know who that was. So your question, why didn't the caretaker come forward sooner? It's because he was an illegal immigrant back in 1957. And he was worried that if he went to the police, that he would be deported, no matter what the situation was. But even worse, this lead didn't go any further for whatever reason. So in the 80s, when they found out about it,
the kids kept their mouth shut, I guess.
It just sat. Kirk left the area in 1960, and he passed management of the Photoshop on to another employee. After that, police completely lost track of him. So that leaves two possibilities of what really happened here. Pat and Margaret actually did leave the area, and they just decided they didn't want to be found, and the letter that was wrote and all the other communication was legitimate. Or someone wanted everybody to think that that was the case, because Pat was the kind of an odd duck that would have just left like that, according to his dad, and people close to him, maybe Kirk, maybe Herb, maybe both, might have put together a little plan saying, you know what, if he disappeared and we did all this, nobody would think anything and we can pretty much keep his money.
Mm-hmm.
Tracy, I definitely think that something sinister went on here. I don't believe they just disappeared. The handwriting, the craziness of who gets what, Herb all of a sudden starting to pull bank.
Yeah.
You know, out of the thing when he didn't do it before. Now, he could have just been doing that anyway, but I wouldn't think he'd start putting himself in that kind of a retainer and making that kind of money if he thought Pat was coming back.
Right.
Because eventually he'd have been like, what the hell, Herb? I mean.
Yeah, and why wouldn't he not leave his stuff to his kids?
Right. Well, his siblings. Yeah, his siblings. Whatever. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the caretaker situation. Why would he make up such an elaborate story and talk about pieces of scalp and blood and all that? You know, first of all, he came forward 20 years later. And why come forward with such an elaborate story and so specific if it wasn't true? I don't know. And why wouldn't she take her cat to the sitter? That's something she always did.
Yeah.
Just too many things, you know. I think Herb and Kirk had everything to gain for this, and that's just what happened. I also don't understand why he took the car over to Cecil, unless it was only to get the story out about him calling him at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Well, yeah, that could have been.
Nothing about that story makes sense. All right. Well, Tracy, we're going to take a quick sponsor break, and then we're going to be back to talk about a place that we know very well.
Oh.
All right, Tracy. 1981, September 25th to be exact.
Great year. Love it.
Thelma Pauline Melton was walking along the Deep Creek Trail. This happens to be in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park in Tennessee. She had been coming and hiking on this trail for 20 years.
She must have really loved it.
Apparently. Needless to say, this was a trail she was very familiar with. Thelma was a 58-year-old woman. On this particular day, she's walking with two friends of hers. They were all part of this big group, I guess, that was staying at the campgrounds. It was about 4 p.m., and the two friends were actually teasing her because she was a little bit slower than normal and was falling behind. So they're up together ahead of her. She's a little bit behind them, and they start teasing her. Thelma sped up past the two girls and starts laughing and commenting on how fast she was going now, and they're laughing. Thelma looked back, started laughing, and then she just kept going. When she was about 75 yards away, she went over a small hill and got out of the girl's sight. Tracy, that was the last time Thelma was ever seen.
What? She fell off a cliff?
They expected to see her along somewhere along the pathway once they climbed over the hill. But when they got over the hill, there was no Thelma. Keep in mind that this was a heavily forested trail. And there were some twists and some turns and some small hills. So it wasn't weird that they didn't see her immediately after. Especially if she was keeping at the pace that she was doing earlier. Then they thought, you know what? She must have just went back to the camper where her husband Robert was. So they get to the camper and she wasn't there either. Robert said he hadn't seen her, in fact, since they left. Yeah. So Robert made some phone calls to some of the other people in the group to see if she had stopped at one of their campers. The two friends told their husbands about the events that had happened, and they decided that they were going to retrace the trail.
Mm-hmm.
They went the entire distance, even though there was lots of people all around. Nobody had seen Thelma. And trust me, they asked almost everybody that they saw. Tracy, did I mention that this trail was 10 miles long?
Oh, wow. No way.
That's the part that they walked back over and traced.
Well, I mean, though, wouldn't she have had to go back the other way?
They probably made a circle.
Back to the camp? Huh?
It maybe made a circle.
Oh.
I don't know that for a fact. But so an hour and a half later, the police were called in. Police arrived soon after, and a thorough search was then started. They closed the trail off so nobody else could come on it, and over the course of the next 4 days, they scouted the area. In total, they searched 100 miles worth of trail.
That's crazy.
There were over 100 searchers, dog teams, in the pathways, and in the forest. There was no sign of any kind of struggle, no scent, and no Thelma. The day that she went on the hike, she had no ID, no wallet, or no key. She left all that back at the house. She also had some medicine she was told to be taking. She didn't take that. The only thing she had with her was her cigarettes. She was a 2-pack-a-day smoker.
Oh, good grief.
She couldn't walk very far or very fast.
Well, I'm sure she can't.
So they were banking on being able to find her pretty easy, and it just wasn't the case. So because of this, police thought that maybe this was a case of foul play. Maybe she'd been abducted by someone along the trail. But Thelma was not a small woman. She was 5'10", 180 pounds. She would not have been an easy target, especially in such a short period of time and on a trail with so many people.
Mm-hmm.
So the police started to explore the possibility that maybe Thelma wanted to disappear. So in this part of the investigation, there were some interesting findings. Unfortunately, they only added to more of the mystery. First of all, Thelma had made a sauce earlier in that day to be used for dinner that night. Why'd you go through trouble making a sauce if you don't plan on being there for dinner?
Yeah, definitely.
So this showed at least the intention to be back. Well, the next strange thing is that in the 4 years prior to her disappearance, Thelma volunteered to hand out food to the elderly during the week. She did this every single day without fail, for as long as Robert could remember, except on the day that she disappeared. For some unknown reason, she decided not to go in that day. Is there a connection?
Oh, who knows? Yeah.
She did it every day for 4 years.
Right. Why was she?
And then that day, she just didn't go in. In addition to that, in those 4 years, she had never used the phone there at that location where she handed out the food. But on the day before she disappeared, she used the phone there. She made a call to somebody that was unknown, and what they talked about was unknown. The only other piece of info that seemed notable from this was her pastor. Her pastor said that Thelma had been struggling with the loss of her mother that had happened earlier that year. But he also said that he believed she was having an affair. But that was never substantiated, but it did lead to speculation. People have suggested that Thelma may have been unhappy with her life. She was married to a man that was 20 years older than her, and Robert just wasn't as mobile or active as her.
Mm-hmm.
She's 58, so he would have been in his late 70s.
Yeah.
Therefore, it was suggested that the call was to her lover and for him to come by and get her. But this seemed pretty crazy because, first of all, she was completely calm on the day of her disappearance. You would think somebody had some kind of plans like that, they would be nervous, but nobody noticed anything different about her that day. She would have had to have completely planned out every single detail.
Yeah.
I mean, everything from the exact time that she went on the hike, the speed up, the exact, you know, right amount of time to be able to get away from people, and then have to have somebody waiting to pick her up at a part where nobody would see her.
It's just, that's too crazy.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like anything would happen. It just doesn't seem likely. So we've got three options. She was either abducted in broad daylight in front of a bunch of people. She was lost in the woods, which is possible. But the third is she planned her disappearance, and to this day, there has never been another trace of Thelma.
Oh. Well, it seems weird that she would be lost in the woods since she's done that trail for 20 years. You'd think she would know where every little branch was.
You know, I was thinking about this. And yes, that sounds logical. But then when you really think about it, though, could you, could she go home and close her eyes and visualize every bit of that trail? It's 10 miles.
No, that's a long trail.
I mean, I've been to places that I've traveled a whole bunch of stuff, like on the roads I've been to. And then every once in a while, I'll be like, oh.
You didn't? I haven't seen that before.
Or, I hadn't seen that before, or I thought this was a little further down. So, yeah, it's very possible that if you only go one time a year for 20 years, I don't know how many times she went, but let's say you go one time a year for 20 years, even if you hike it a couple times, that's a big difference in between to where you may not know every nook and cranny.
Well, that's probably true.
But it is a trail. Trails you don't typically go off of.
No.
I mean, why would she have went off and where they wouldn't have found her? It just...
Yeah, because I don't see how she was that far ahead that they wouldn't have noticed even
taking over the hill for somebody. If there's that many people on there and say you fall down somewhere, somebody's bound to see you.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a very strange disappearance type story.
Yeah, it is.
So, aliens, Bigfoot, mm-hmm. could be anything.
Yeah, definitely. So. Or maybe she took off with Louise.
Nice. All right, guys. We are going to take a quick sponsor break. We'll be right back to talk about some stuff going on, and then we'll talk to Cody Richardson. All right, Tracy. So, we've got the August birthday party for us, 8-year anniversary party.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful?
With History Goes Bump in St. Augustine. I want to make sure I remind people that we've got some contact information up to call Beecher's Lodge. They do have rooms at special rates for you guys. It is a fantastic place to stay. You are right on the beach. They have a pool and the beach and a pond. I don't know about the pond. They got several water sources. But no, it's a fantastic place to stay. You'll absolutely love it there. And like I said, the prices are very fair. Call and tell them you were with the podcast for that day so you get the special rate and we get credit for it.
Yep, we appreciate that, and we can't wait to see all of you guys out there.
Yeah, it's going to be an absolute blast. Of course, History Goes Bump will be there with us, and who knows, I might have a special guest or two somewhere along the way.
Nice.
You know, maybe somebody like Eminem? probably not.
Peanut or plain?
Probably not. All right, so we got that going on. That's the cruise. We're on the tail end of getting on the cruise. You only got about a month and a half to get it paid for. Jump in there. Let's get this thing done.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, Tracy, what do you got going on over there?
Well, right now, hardly nothing, to be honest.
True.
We would like to say thank you to Kay Cummings for leaving us a review. And I'm sure Mojo Lobster will.
We are a day early.
We're a day early. But thank you, guys. Keep those reviews coming. It just pushes us up the chart. So people can find us, and we definitely need that to happen. And we just thank you guys for all that you do for us.
Also, I'm going to throw this in, because I started thinking about why I haven't done this before. I sell furniture for Hudson's Furniture and Mattress in Ormond Beach. Now, that's only about an hour from Orlando and some of the other places that listen to us. So if you need furniture, come see me at Hudson's.
And their shit's the bomb.
It is.
It's awesome.
So, yeah, it's a high-end furniture store. So most of our stuff is kind of expensive. But if you need furniture, come see me. I'm there almost every damn day. All right. With that being said, let's listen to Cody Richardson. Hey, guys. I'm excited about this one because we've only had a handful of YouTubers on the show before. And it's been a long time since we've had one. I mean, we've had some that have podcasts too, but not necessarily a show as big as this one. We've got Cody Richardson on from Mystery Archives, 229,000 subscribers. And just to give you an idea of how good his content goes over, they put out an episode yesterday on a demonic haunting of the house on Church Street. It's got 24,000 downloads already. Or I guess I should say views. I get these whole podcasting and YouTube stuff mixed up. But that is absolutely incredible. Cody, thanks for coming on with us.
Oh, man, thank you for the amazing introduction. I appreciate it. I feel honored.
I would be willing to bet there's a lot of our listeners who have heard that voice before from the YouTube videos. You put out a good quality content. It's the same type of stories that we cover. It's all over the place. If it's paranormal related, you've covered it. I think what you do is some of the best work out there. And I would be lying if I said that I didn't watch your channel all the time, because I do.
Oh, man. Well, I'm more than honored then. I appreciate that so much.
I'm one of these people, Cody, that I go to, it sounds so creepy, but I go to bed to your voice. I don't know how many nights a month, because you've got one of those voices that's very soothing when you listen. I mean, it's a very calm, narration that you do. And to me, that's like perfect to just sit back when I want to zone out. And that's why I like it. Half the time I don't watch the videos, which I know sucks because you put a lot of time into these videos.
But like I'm a bit of an audiophile myself. So I try to build up. I always do the audio first, you know, before the video. And I try to sprinkle little things in there, like, you know, like storm noises or little sounds to try and just make the storytelling a little bit better. Yeah, no, it's not creepy. I get that a lot, actually. So if anything, I appreciate it, man. I really do.
So how long have you been doing the YouTube channel?
So I've been doing Mystery Archives now for, geez, it's coming up on 5 years. Full-time, yeah. Like full-time, full board. I just left my day job, actually, almost a year ago. So I've been sustaining myself through YouTube for about a year now, full on. And it's been great. It's had its ups and downs, but it's a lot of work, but it's really rewarding, you know, if you're lucky enough for things to pay off.
What's your favorite part? Is it researching? Is it writing the story? Is it doing the video part of it? What part's your favorite?
That's a great question. I think I have to find different aspects of each process that I enjoy, but everything to an extent seems like a bit of a slog, you know, as far as like scripting it out, because scripts for me can take anywhere between 2 and 3 weeks, especially if there's like a book or two involved. And the writing in and of itself, you know, I try to write it in a way that I know will make a good video, you know, try to be factual, but also entertaining. And yeah, not to get too long-winded here, but I think probably when it comes down to it, the video editing process, even though it is also one heck of a grind, I think that just being able to sneak little Easter eggs in there and stuff is just, it's fun for me.
How has it changed as far as like your research and your writing the video, the whole thing, how you put an episode together? How's it changed from where you started to what you do now? Because people learn as they go and they figure that different things work better for them than others, or they try different formats. We've tried, I don't know how many formats, and twist it around. I know you do some videos that, not to compare you to people, but style, mm-hmm. you know, like a Mr. Ballin where you're on the screen telling the stories. What Lurks Beneath is another good one that does that style. And you've done some of that, and then you've done just other just straight up videos. Tell me a little bit about the experimentation and what works best for you.
Yeah, sure thing. So I started out, I mean, obviously never thought it would get to this point, but the very first video I made was about the legends that are around Stoll, Kansas. I don't know if you've heard of Stoll Cemetery or not. It's sure. quite famous
you
now.
You got the steps and...
Yeah, the steps and the church and all that good stuff. So I grew up watching like all sorts of stuff, like X-Files and... the name is eluding me just now, but lots of shows that influenced me. What's that?
Sightings. That was another big one back then.
Sightings. Oh, okay. Unsolved Mysteries. That's where I was trying to think of. And I still watch a lot of Unsolved Mysteries, but basically I had an idea for, you know, the format back then and tried it. And really that's kind of what things have evolved to into now, rather. So basically lots of imagery and trying to convey the story, I guess, as entertainingly as I can. I've experimented with other stuff. Like I remember way back then after the Stoll video, I did kind of like some creepypasta type narrations, like stories that weren't necessarily true, but I was just kind of trying to get myself out there as a narrator. Right. And then really I just started digging back and thinking about different shows that I enjoyed. And one of my favorite shows, I mean, it can be kind of cheesy, but is A Haunting. That's one of my all-time favorites from growing up.
That's my favorite too. And
it's
because that's like the perfect show to me as far as a paranormal show. They break it down really good. You get a little bit of narration, and at the same time you get the recreation of what's going on.
The reenactment, the interviews. So I've always wanted to do something kind of like that, but in my own way, I guess, if that makes sense. And that's kind of how I came up with the Untold Story, which ironically I ended up just keeping the name of that because it worked on YouTube. I just tried different things out. I mean, I tried, I don't even know how many different strategies when it comes to growing my channel, and nothing seemed to work, which was driving me insane. And one day my video on Helltown actually just popped off. And then from there we were off to the races. But I've tried, along with those different strategies and different suggestions from, you know, people I look up to, or different online guides. I tried different formats, kind of like the Mr. Ballin type format where you're on screen, telling the story, just to see how my audience liked it, to see, you know, if it could kind of push me out there to a bit of a bigger audience, or if they prefer just, you know, the narration style content. And I've got, you know, a good chunk that likes it and a good chunk that doesn't. So that's why I've kind of mostly gone back to the narration style. But I feel like every once in a while I'll hop on it, you know, maybe do something if it befits the story.
You've got a good quality video. I mean, no matter what episode I watch, you could tell from somebody who's done a little bit of video in the past and knows how hard it is to get content to make it fit what you're trying to do. You just do such a great job with the videos. It's the experience you put behind it is very clear.
Oh, well, thank you, man. I really appreciate that. I definitely do my best.
It's hard, and again, it sounds like I'm kissing your ass, but that's really not what's going on. I'm just amazed at, on your channel, when I watch anything Mystery Archives, it's always well written. It's always a fascinating story. It's always narrated pretty much perfectly, and then the video's great too. So I mean, it really, for me, I've never been disappointed with any of the videos I've watched. Never.
I really appreciate that. I feel like some videos, I mean, I guess, you know, you're going to be your own biggest critic, but I think some videos are better than others. Just me knowing where I was at when I was making them, I guess, you know, like sometimes you're more on point than others. But yeah, I always try to pick something that I'm personally interested in. And, you know, I'd like to think that my audience will be interested in it too. You know, like if I find it fascinating, I try to do a deep dive and then make it as concise of a story as I can, but make it entertaining.
How do you come up with most of your stories?
So that's a great question. These days, it's usually audience recommendations, or if I just happen to stumble across something, whether, you know, it's on a website or like TikTok or what have you. Anything that pops up that looks interesting, I'll check it out. And I mean, if it's got enough substance, I'm more than happy to dive into it. But I would say probably the last, like, geez, probably like at least 40 videos have mostly been audience recommendations.
Well, and that's where it also helps having such a huge audience, is you find those little diamonds in the rough.
Oh yeah.
You know, like probably the story that you covered yesterday, the house on Church Street, mm-hmm. That was a story I was unfamiliar with.
And really?
Yeah. And anytime I find one of those that I'm like, hey, I don't really know. And it's amazing. Some of them can be bigger stories out there, and you still haven't heard that. Just when people say, aren't you afraid you're going to run out of stories? Nope.
You know, I thought that when I first started. I was like, man, I feel like at some point I'm going to reach the end, but there's just so many out there, you know?
Yeah, we were covering, we were doing some of our Hillbilly Shorts, which is our Patreon stuff earlier.
Nice.
And I literally didn't have anything to cover specifically. And I just told Tracy, I said, pick a city. She said, Baltimore. So I looked up Haunted Baltimore and found like four stories to cover.
Oh, nice.
Stories I'd never heard of, just because, you know, but that's just right from one city. I mean, how many cities are out there? And then they got
so many
cities like Stull, that's a little bitty town. Right. You know, but they've got stories, or Atchison, Kansas, or, you know, yeah, Atchison, Illinois.
Yeah, I've been out to Atchison a few times. I live out here in Kansas, and Atchison from where I'm at is about, give or take, like a 3-3.5 hour drive. And we've gone out there and done some investigational work at the Sally House. And Atchison as a whole has its own like weird energy to it. I don't know. It's a weird little place. Like, I'm not surprised that they say it's the most haunted place in Kansas, because it feels that way.
And Alton, Illinois has that same kind of feel. If you've ever been to Alton, it's a similar feel. Alton and Atchison are really close.
I was going to say I haven't, but I would definitely be open to visiting.
they're also listed as like one of the most haunted places. That's where Troy Taylor lives, and he does his Haunted America conference out there a lot of times.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah,
man, I apparently must just live under a rock. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's a really cool place to visit. So let's talk a little bit about the house on Church Street. Give me a synopsis, because we don't want to give it all away. We want people to go watch the video. But give me a synopsis, the trailer, so to speak, of if somebody was to come and watch. Give me the breakdown of what happens in the video.
So the story takes place in Standish, Michigan, if I can talk, in Standish, Michigan. And it's centered around a man named Randy Irvin, who he graduates high school. He's kind of couch surfing and partying. He doesn't really have any main plans. And he ends up getting a job at the post office and wants to clean up his life a little bit and, you know, wants his independence, so to speak. So his dad actually buys and flips old properties and or makes them rentals. And basically his dad was like, well, if you help me remodel this house, then you can live here. I'm like, okay, cool. So he's working during the day. He's getting off at night, going and helping his dad. And they are doing some renovation work in the basement of this home. And this home's over, I think they said it was at least 105 years old at the time. And this was back in the 70s. I believe it took place in 1974. So they're digging up the flooring there, and they find a human femur bone. And they're like, that's bizarre. So basically from there, again, not to be too long-winded, but that pretty much ends up being an old Native American burial ground, which is actually really common in Standish even today. So they find this bone. Randy gets really interested in the occult and ends up summoning some stuff that he really shouldn't have, and gets pretty tortured by four various entities. And pretty much the story is his struggle of how he's dealing with all of that and trying to keep his family safe and trying to stay sane while dealing with the things that he unleashed on himself accidentally, if that makes sense. Hopefully that's a good enough synopsis off the top of the head.
That's enough. I'd go watch it, and I've already seen it. So,
well, again, thank you so much.
What are some of the episodes that you've done in the past? You've got 5 years worth of episodes out there, at least.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are some of the stories that just stand out to you that were some of your favorites that you covered?
Oh man. That's a great question. Bobby Mackey's was a really fun one to study and learn about. And I just heard that they're actually moving locations, and that original location is going to be demolished. Which makes me really sad, because I really wanted to go investigate there. that's definitely one of my favorites, though. Bobby Mackey's, for sure, down in Wilder, Kentucky.
Yeah, I've been there more times than I can count.
Really?
So, oh, yeah, I mean, we lived in Lexington. We were literally an hour away.
Oh, you know, that makes sense.
So, yep. So we, we would go up there, and we used to do live events there. So I think we did 4 live events there, and we've had some listeners get scratched while at our live event.
We had
Bobby Mackey actually come out to one of the shows and sang a little bit for us and did a little interview for us. So
that's cool. I mean, he seems definitely still very much like a skeptical guy, but I think his approach to it has been, you know, pretty good, you know, because he might not personally buy into it, but he's tried definitely to capitalize on it in a way that isn't, you know, blatantly awful. So good,
right.
Good for him.
Yeah, he, the place is falling apart. I mean, that's the reality of it.
It's a really, you know, old building. I did know that.
If you go to try to do a tour there and they'll let you go upstairs, I don't know why, but they will let you go upstairs to like Carl, the care tender, his place where he lived. But they'll tell you enter at your own risk because floor's falling apart. Oh. It's very risky to be walking around in any of that area, but they'll take people up there. And, you know, I actually had heard from, you know, like I said, Bobby's one of my Facebook friends, and we have a lot of people who work for Bobby that I'm close with that told me 6 months ago they're going to tear it down. But then it came out that, hey, we're just going to move temporarily while we renovate this. And I kept telling people that's not what's going to happen. I'm telling you. I think he wanted to kind of soak in a little bit and get to the new place and all that. And then it finally came out here, I guess, in the last month and a half or 2 months that, yeah, they're going to go ahead and tear it down.
It's too bad, but I mean, some stuff you just can't fix, you know, if it's that old and it's that dilapidated. I mean, it becomes a risk at that point, a liability. So I understand it from a business owner's perspective, no doubt.
Yep. But, you know, yeah, Bobby Mackey's, though, that's actually one of the best stories out there. I love the whole story on that.
Yeah, I agree. I love the whole thing as well. Man, I would have loved to I'd still love to interview Bobby Mackey if given the opportunity. But Carl Lawson would have been an interesting guy to talk to as well.
Oh, I'm sure.
Unfortunately, I don't think he's with us any longer. I believe he passed away a couple years ago.
Yeah, he passed away, I think, maybe 5-6 years ago, but it's been a while. Oh,
dang. Yeah, I guess so, man. I'm just behind on my dates then. But
it's always like that,
Bobby Mackey's is a wild story, man.
So you're in Kansas. Obviously, we all know about Stoll Cemetery, including the big battle from Supernatural happening there.
Oh, but, yeah.
But aside from the Sally House and, of course, Stoll, what other kind of stories really stand out from somebody who lives in Kansas?
Again, man, awesome question. I did a vlog a long time ago from this place, but there's a more local place. I'd say it's about a 40-minute drive from where I'm at. I used to live in this little town called Sedgwick, and there's maybe, I think, 1,100 people there. There was less people there when I lived there. but right outside of it, right in between where Sedgwick's at, there's another town called Valley Center. And right in between there, if you were headed, I think it's northwest, give or take, there's a bridge called Theorosis Bridge. And there's, I want to say, three different, you know, with a lot of these local folklore type stories, there's always multiple origin stories, right? But the one that I grew up hearing was that this native woman there is a version that has a Native American involved, but basically there was a child born out of wedlock long, long time ago. There used to be a river that ran through there, and the old original bridge was wooden. And basically a mother sacrificed her child there, and because, you know what I mean, having kids out of wedlock was a no-no. It was right. A big family dilemma at the time. And then she sacrificed herself. So that's the general story. I don't know how true it is, but it's always creepy to go out there because now, so they've built a newer bridge up over atop where the original bridge was, but the original posts are all still there from, I think, the late 1800s, early 1900s. And every time I've been out there, there's always a ton of animal bones, which is really weird.
That is weird.
Like, and there's been like a lot of animal carcasses and stuff. And this is all at like years in between trips too, which I always thought was strange. It's just a weird energy down there. So it's like, even if that origin story perhaps wasn't true, something weird about the area, or maybe enough people have given it thought form to where it's a beacon of strangeness. But yeah, a lot of kids go out there to party and explore. And we used to go out there. My mom used to take us actually when we were little kids, and you know, obviously get us all hyped up around Halloween, go take us out to Theorosis Bridge, and she'd drive over it. And I remember one time our car battery died, and that's apparently a thing that happens too, is when people drive over it, their batteries die. And I just remember being really freaked out with my brother and sister at the time. But yeah, just, it's a weird little place. That's the first one that comes to mind for sure, the main one, because I was going to default to Sally House because I know a lot more about the Sally House. But
yeah, but I took that one out.
Yeah, no,
we spent the night in a Sally House back in 2019.
Nice. Yeah, I was there 2021, I believe. Did you guys sign the little guest book thing?
I don't remember if we did or not, to be honest with you.
I was like, I wonder if I saw your signature in there way back when. I just didn't think about it, you know?
The coolest thing about our trip there is my wife left her glasses in there, her prescription reading glasses.
Oh, no.
And we were already gone. And Maria, who was actually running the director of tourism there at the time, mm-hmm. she just said, well, here's the code, because, you know, it had one of those push button codes on the door at that time.
Yeah.
So I went in and was the only person in there. This was daytime. It was still, you know, it was early in the morning, probably 11 or so.
Yeah.
But I was the only person in there for about 10 minutes. And I took my time and walked around into each room, even though we spent the night there. There was, mm-hmm. you know, I think six or seven of us that spent the night, and there was a paranormal crew from Nebraska. Chris, can't remember Chris's last name, Chris Case. His group from Nebraska was in there, and we had some the young lady was with him was from Ghost Hunters International.
I figured it was Ghost Hunters.
Yeah.
Nice. But that's
she
awesome.
She was in there. Yeah, Bill Murray was in there, and there was a crowded night the whole time. Right. That was the only chance I was like, hey, I'm by myself. It's daytime, but I'm by myself. So I kind of went the night before when Chris and his group was there, they were hearing some growling coming from one of the closets.
Oh, wow.
They were supposed to spend the night the next night, and they changed their mind, decided not to.
Oh, wow.
Because they didn't feel comfortable. So I went in, here I am by myself in the daytime. I went in the closet and I'm taking pictures, and, you know, it's just that kind of stuff just doesn't faze me. But
what, you know. So the closet, was it the one, you may or may not remember, I just figured I'd ask, but when you go straight up the staircase to go upstairs, was it the room on the far right, that bigger closet?
No, but so when you go up to the top of the steps, you've got like the nursery to the left.
Yeah.
You've got the bathroom.
Yep.
Then you've got another room and then another room.
Mm-hmm.
It was in that last bedroom. So if you went up to the top of the steps and just took a right and went straight in that room, that was the room.
Yeah, that was the one okay. with the kind of weird shaped ceilings. I mean, I guess all the ceilings are kind of a weird shape.
Yeah, that part I don't remember. I just remember we stayed in that room right to the right of the bathroom, that kind of the middle, because you got the nursery, that room, and we stayed in the middle room.
Right, that makes sense. Yeah, we when I went, actually, I took two of my friends and my cousin, and it was my first, I guess you could call it, paranormal investigation that I conducted myself. So pretty amateur hour moment. But yeah, we caught some orbs in that closet, actually. And I remember I was trying to provoke, but nothing like too aggressive, just to try to get, you know, stir something up in there. And my friend, who at the time didn't really believe in any of this stuff, he got touched. Because his back was facing towards that closet. So that's what prompted us to open the door and to go ahead and take photos in there. I'll see if I could find those later, maybe send them to you. But yeah, we caught a few orbs in there for sure.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Definitely.
All right, we're listening to Cody Richardson from the YouTube channel Mystery Archives. 229,000 subscribers. Man. I dream of a day that we might actually be able to do that on YouTube. So we're working on it. Cody, it's been
a process, man.
It is. Cody, it's been a pleasure having you on, brother. It's I think I was more excited about this one than I have been the last 10 interviews combined. So,
oh man. Well, again, thank you so much. You've been an awesome host, and hopefully I wasn't too disappointing.
No, not at all. And I'll tell you what was funny is, well, let's bring up a mutual friend of ours, Bob Hicks.
Sure. Yeah.
From Tales of the Dark. He helps me out on as much stuff as he possibly can. As a matter of fact, Tracy and I just did his show with Britt a couple of days ago. So that'll be airing here soon. But Bob actually hooked us up. And I didn't realize when he said, hey, you'd like Cody. He's got a big YouTube page and stuff. But I didn't know your last name at the time, you know, when he just said Cody, and I wasn't even thinking about it. And then when he told me the show, I'm like, I know that show. I watch that channel all the time. So then I was like a little schoolgirl from that point on, where before it was like, okay, cool. It's another guest, you know, we'll hook up. And then all of a sudden it was just like, man, when can we do this?
And I very much appreciate that, man. Yeah. Bob's a great guy for sure. I just, it's so funny because, I mean, even given the size of my following and whatnot, I still don't really think of it as being like a really big show, you know, or like people that like regularly watch it. Like, I know that there are people, but it just hasn't quite sunk in. But it's, yeah, it's cool, man. I appreciate you having me.
No, it's no problem, man. So, hey, what's his other YouTube channel?
Yeah, so he's got Tales from the Dark, and then he just launched one called The Missing Chapter, which is more true crime related. Great stuff. Right.
So go check that out, guys. Go subscribe to Mystery Archive. Start watching some videos. You'll be hooked as soon as you watch one of them. Trust me. But start with the newest one that came out, because if there's ever a true representation of the channel, it's that episode.
Yeah, it definitely was a return to form, and a lot of work went into it. So I very, not to sound like a broken record, but I very much would appreciate it.
Awesome. Cody, thanks for coming on, buddy.
Thank you very much, man. And it's been great. Appreciate you.
That was so much fun to do. Absolutely love Mystery Archives. Go subscribe. Trust me, if you like YouTube, do that. Hey, and while you're on YouTube,
go check us out.
Even though it's the same thing you probably just heard on the other channel. But come check us out anyway. It's still fun. It still helps.
Yeah, it still helps. Anything y'all do and look at and everything, it helps. And we appreciate it.
Yes, absolutely. And the one thing that I'll challenge all of you on this week, just tell one friend about us. A different one that you have. Because if you already told other friends they're not listening, that's not doing any good. Tell another friend about us, and let's see if we can get them listening. All right, guys, we love you. We'll talk to you later.
Have a blessed week. Love you guys.